Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Lynn Anderson of KSK Radio here in Anchorage. Let's go ahead and start with Kyle Hopkins. Kyle, Corey Rossi, one of the highest ranking officials in the Department of Fish and Game, departed and departed very quickly after he was charged with a variety of game law violations. Tell us about this, and one of the things we'd like to know is how did he get in that position, how did he win that prominent position to begin with?
Well, Corey Rossi, right, he was, that was a big job that he held at Fish and Game, an important job. You know, he as Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation, this is someone who was very closely associated with predator control, you know, was kind of a champion of predator control, and that's, you know, and his agency is very influential when it comes to working with the Board of Game to create regulations for, you know, how hunters hunt and what animals are available for them to hunt. And he was associated with the Palin family in the sense that, that Sarah Palin's folks worked with him. They recommended him for the job. I think there are emails from Palin saying where she kind of disavows that a little bit. But certainly they, had told the AP back when he was appointed, selected by Denby Lloyd to be the head of
then
that division.
Commissioner.
Right. That he's a good guy, ethical guy, you know, kind of a stand-up guy. But he didn't start in that job. He started in a newly created job, which was to oversee abundance management, which is kind of another word for predator control, and then was elevated to the division director. And that was a controversial choice at the time. Biologists revolted, and it's just kind of steeped in this war between, sports hunters and environmentalists, or maybe not environmentalists, but people who say that the state errs on the side of sports hunters,
and
that they kill too many predators.
There'd be native voices involved here, or bush rural voices, and this is a position that doesn't require confirmation by the legislature.
Right, yeah, I mean, I guess you could look at it as a triangle, right? You've got sport hunters, you've got people who would describe themselves either as environmentalists or just people, who want more science-based management, and then you've got some, subsistence hunters, native hunters in the bush who think that the sports hunters are getting too much, and so you're really under the microscope when you have that job. And there was a little bit of a revolt when he got hired, in the sense that there were, lots of biologists signed a letter saying that they didn't think he was qualified for it. But he was a charismatic guy, and even people who don't like him said he's, kind of a nice guy and kind of knew how to get things done. Politically.
And eventually the charges proved to be what specifically?
Yeah, in short, he before he was working for the state, when he was working for the feds, he went on a hunt with some other guys. He was buddies with at least one of them, guys from out of state. They went on a black bear hunt. This is a time and a place where black bears were, there was predator control going on for black bears. So it's not like there was a lack of black bears. I mean, lots of black bears were being killed in that area at the time. He and his buddies killed some black bears. Rossi admitted to lying about kind of who killed what on some paperwork. And that's kind of the root of it is, just the falsified paperwork and then the fact that he was a licensed assistant guide at the time. Like when you commit a crime like that, if you're licensed as a guide or an assistant guide, then you face a whole bunch more charges, more misdemeanor charges, because you're kind of held to a higher standard. There was an undercover investigation out of Utah or another state where, according to the trooper supervisor who I spoke with, some of these hunters that were involved with Rossi, they were just talking about this hunt. The guys from out of state got on the phone.
Wasn't that say bragging in the paper?
Yeah, they were just bragging about a hunt that, somebody's ears perks up. They call Alaska, says, hey, you might want to look into this. And then the Alaska troopers kind of sit on it until the other investigation is over, and then they launch their investigation into Rossi. And, sure enough, he, last month they just kind of swooped in and interviewed all these guys at once, and many of them admitted to kind of pieces of wrongdoing, and so he resigned when confronted, you know, like right ahead of those charges becoming public.
And these are misdemeanors, is that correct?
Yeah, all misdemeanors.
Okay. You know. All right, thank you, Vic Kyle. Jill Fairbanks, militiaman Schaefer Cox, who's been on the news for months now, I think at least a year at this point, was in federal court with some of his colleagues in the militia movement. They wanted to challenge sections of their indictment, their federal indictment. How did it go? Court here in Anchorage, I should say.
Yeah, they are having those trials take place in Anchorage. The big headline from this week, in addition to the fact that they're largely being denied with their efforts to have evidence tossed out, is that they were re-indicted or newly indicted in a superseding indictment on murder conspiracy charges, which is a big, big deal because that carries a potential life sentence for the
three
men.
Is that attempted murder? Nobody's died, right?
Nobody has died. They're claiming that the three of them, Lonnie Vernon, Coleman Barney, and Schaefer Cox, who's the Fairbanks militia leader, who was kind of the ringleader of this group, are accused of coming up with this plot to retaliate, kidnap, and kill federal officials, state troopers, and others who might try to intervene and potentially arrest Cox on what at the time was a misdemeanor bench warrant, I believe. So he was resisting that. He gets himself into trouble. The case at hand, in addition to the murder conspiracy charges, is really a weapons case. But the defense, prior to the news Monday, that the defendants had been charged with this murder conspiracy.
Can I interrupt just briefly?
Yeah.
The murder charge, that sounds similar to what has been done with plotting terrorists in New York City and other places.
It is, and it is not a domestic terrorism case, but it has all the hallmarks of it. I mean, the Joint Terrorism Task Force was the lead investigating agency, in addition to Alaska State Troopers. And although they're being charged with weapons violations, and again, this murder conspiracy charge, they're not charged specifically with terrorism. But until Monday, when they had to plead not guilty to those new charges, the defendants were in the process of fighting various aspects of the evidence against them. Was some of the weapons that are charged actually weapons, these grenade launchers and, you know, canisters of hornet's nests? And if they were used together, is it fair to call them weapons when they're less lethal than rifles? This is the argument that the defendants made. The judge said that one doesn't have any merit. This is a weapon by definition. You're just out of luck. Then they tried to attack various aspects of how the search and seizures took place the day of the arrest. And they wanted to toss out this trailer that had some weapons in it that had been stored at a park in Fairbanks. And that got denied. And then now the most recent one that's kind of in limbo, waiting for the judge to make a decision after some additional motion work takes place, is whether or not any of this should have been allowed, because the main witness, the initial witness, who's the militia infiltrator who testified to the FBI, who the FBI then took to a judge and said, look, we're hearing these things, give us the search warrants and allow us to do this investigation, that guy was just absolutely not trustworthy. And he's not. I mean, his life as a civilian and his court records show that time and time again he gets himself into trouble for swindling people and conning them out of money, whether it's a septic sewer scam or whether it's, you know, selling a log cabin and never delivering, or whether it's doing, home refurnishing projects that are done either shoddily or incomplete. He takes the money, disappears, and none of these victims are ever made whole. So he has this long history of kind of, you know, these trails of disaster behind him. And the defense is arguing, look, the judge who was signing off on this for the FBI, saying, yeah, go ahead with your searches and your investigation, should have known the full extent of this guy's criminal history, not just that he was a previously convicted felon, he was also facing new felony charges. And they believe that if the judge had known that, the judge might not have said, go ahead and do it. He may have, you know, stopped everything there. I don't know that they'll win that, but they're definitely giving it a good try.
And that's what they've got left to argue, I guess, and that's part of the reason they're so vigorous in it.
Yes, and I mean, we'll see additional, I imagine evidence charges and witness charges and, or not charges, challenges come up as
we move
towards
this. Yeah, this would be where the defense contests everything.
Yeah, towards this May trial, and, you know, that's what they do. They need to challenge the legitimacy of what's been brought forward.
Thank you. Let's bring Lynn Anderson in here. Lynn, the Anchorage School District proposes its budget for 12, and it's about $6.2 million. less than last year. Well, last year was like some $733 million. What happened with the budget this year? And it seems to have, there were some commentary by Superintendent Cuomo, but I didn't really see this as being as disputed as in other years.
Okay, well, as is often true of, well, I guess of budgets associated with the municipality of Anchorage, it demands a little preface. First of all, when someone, if you go to the Anchorage School District website and you look at last year's total budget, it's up above $800 million. So what they have done is change the process of dealing with the PERS and TERS to match the municipality. The municipality over the years has never included in its revenues and expenditures the PERS and TERS that comes from the state, that support to
retirement.
To meet, the retirement that demands. The school district did, which led itself open to some susceptibility when people would say, look at the size of the school budget, look at the city, where is this? So what this in part, and Carol Cuomo made it clear, they notified the municipality and that sort of thing, that they were no longer including the pass-through funds from the state. So if you go and you say, well, what was it last year if it was, you know, 6.2 less? Well, this is eliminating.
So we're in the land here of apples and pineapples? Is that what we're comparing?
We may be actually approaching apples and apples. So it's even more unusual, perhaps, in Anchorage. So the 6.2 million is dealing with those items exclusive of PERS and TERS. So you wind up with $726 million, something now, like that. That's total. Now that includes the bonds and everything. Now the 6.2 million less is revenue, and that for the most part reflects the absence this year of the Recovery Act job stimulus money.
Federal Obama
the federal,
money.
The federal Obama money that enabled them in part to hire some 81 teachers. So that's where the reduction comes from. There is no straight line here when you're doing going into the
and
budget.
Carol Cuomo objected, but I didn't think it was the superintendent as, the, what should we say, strident's the word, but as vocal as in other years. What do you think?
I think it's finally reaching the point where she has seen trends continue. She can't get the forward funding, or the forward funding is kind of fading. If they're going to get extra funding out of this, it's going to have to come from the legislature once again, which makes them puts them back in a position of having to issue layoffs, having to cut programs, and then the money comes through from the state, and then you go through after the painful process of what's coming up now over the next 2 weeks of two public readings, where people testifying, trying to defend what they believe is crucial for their kids, what's crucial for the overall district, and then you have to do the reverse. And
part of this is because the budgets of the city and state, or the school district and the state, are not congruent. They don't, you know, they don't work on the same schedule, right?
That's true. That does not help any. And now the the city is taking a more active role in how much you can raise the mill rate. And that's been going for a couple of years, so at least that's up front.
Can I just ask, so this sounds like a good deal for the incoming superintendent, right? Because you're selling, because they've changed the way they've defined the budget,
yes.
Right? So the guy coming in, one of these two who've come through, if they choose one of them, right? He's only got to sell a 700 and something million dollar budget to the city, to the public, mm-hmm. as opposed to the $800 million budget, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a more accurate way of portraying the situation when, since there have, it's been so common to say that, look at the city's budget, look at the school district budget, and at least now when people do that, the comparison is fairer.
Now, Len, you have covered Superintendent Carol Cuomo for many years since you came here to KSK and to Anchorage.
Actually, before that.
Before that, too.
I first encountered her when I was in Native News with KNBA, and there was that coyote flap over the book. And the then Superintendent Crystal sent Carol in as an assistant to face that particular dilemma.
I was going to ask you, given your experience with her, and all the coverage you've done. What has made her so unusually successful as Anchorage superintendent?
Well, you don't find many superintendents in a school district that started as a temporary playground attendant and a teacher's aide while, in Carol's case, while she awaited her certification to catch up from Washington State. It was like she's got to be around the kids. And to have risen step by step, and I think she enjoyed each step. It was as if they came to her. She obviously had to apply. One of the candidates who was vying to replace her simply said, I wanted to be a superintendent from the beginning. I don't think that's true of Carol as she went through. I think they came and this was just an advancement for the education. The other thing, I think she has a tendency to face problems directly. Something comes out, she calls a press conference. I think one of her hardest moments as superintendent was when there was the AFACT meeting, the community group, the group of 13 churches held a meeting, and it was for Native parents expressing a lot of disapproval of the way the school district was handling Native students. And as the blonde parent of a family of Native students at the time, some of it hit. And Carol was really moved because she regarded that as a failure. And I remember telling her from living within Native communities and everything, and I think this part getting to your question, is that those people would not have come forward to that meeting if they did not think Carol would listen.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, okay. And the other thing is that I don't think emotionally and mentally she's ever left the classroom. The happiest I ever saw her was one time she was coming back to the old, in front of the old school district, and she's got this big smile on, and I was there to pick up some form or something, and I said, what's up? And she said, I just judged the spelling bee at Tyson Elementary among student one, a little boy who was in our English as Second Language program a year ago. He won, Len, he won.
That's an unusual woman. Yeah. Okay, Kyle, moose are dying in droves. Old timers here know that we can expect this in the winter. But those who have been around a long time wonder what's happening. What is happening?
It's cold and it's snowing and there's lots of snow, and that's hard for the moose to get around in. You know, you're a big moose, you're trying to get through the snow. It's easier to get on packed snow to get on a road where cars are.
And this is why you see moose in your neighborhood at the Anchorage Daily News parking lot.
Yeah,
they get out of the deep snow.
Yeah, there's one outside this morning. Last Friday, I went to a neighbor. I don't know if I'll do a story on it or not, but I went to a neighborhood and where there's like an orphan moose that's just kind of hanging out, sticking its head, trying to stick its face in doorways and stuff. I was on the phone this morning on a different story with someone in Shugnak who just, mentioned that, like, same situation there, right? It's like 52 below there today in Shugnak, like up by Cotsby, right?
Right.
And, they got 5-6 feet of snow, and, that's a place where I imagine there's not paved roads, but there's hard pack, going through town. And so the moose, I mean, what's it going to do? It's going to hang out where it can get around. So you're seeing that in the valley. You're seeing that here. I don't know how things are in Fairbanks, but...
And the deaths they've been able to count, because the railroad, for one, who the moose want to be on the tracks to get away from the snow. It's in the hundreds, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not like a crazy year for moose deaths on the railroad, but it's, I think we reported that between October and about now, like 2-3 times as many dead moose as the same period last year. And, what's the difference? Well, it's colder this year. There's more snow this year.
Okay, thank you. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Kyle Hopkins, Jill Burke, and Len Anderson. Len, you've spent long hours covering the Anchorage Municipal Assembly. We're about to have an election here this spring. How's it shaping up between the incumbent mayor, Dan Sullivan, and his apparent major challenger, Paul Honeman, who's on the Assembly?
Well, I think it's intriguing about this race is, unlike the two previous ones, where you had Mark Begich, a progressive, against first two conservatives, Maestrom and Wirch, and then against Jack Frost for the second run. And then the collection of candidates, but this time it seems to be narrowing down. And then with Sullivan, you had Croft, the more liberal candidate. This time it seems to be Dan Sullivan, Mayor Dan Sullivan, the conservative and self-proclaimed moderate. So we could have quite a battle for the middle here, and what influence the equal rights initiative on the ballot is going to make. How many people are going to come from which direction, how strong that is. I have watched Dan Sullivan in front of small community councils and others. He is a consummate campaigner, particularly in this area, in Anchorage. He's, I think, tried to blunt some of Honeman's strongest criticism about the port, about public safety, with the police academy, and Sheffield's current position, situation. Is it enough to satisfy the moderates? This could be real. Real intriguing.
Okay, we need to move along. Jill, the Renda, Russian vessel, reaches Nome delivering fuel. How much fuel did it deliver, and what does this tell us about the future?
It delivered between 1.3 and 1.4 million gallons of combined petroleum products, diesel, and gasoline. Of course, it had to carve its way up to Nome through the Bering Sea frozen pack ice led by the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Healy.
Lots of dramatic footage.
First of its kind event, making that kind of a tanker load in the middle of winter when you have these ice clogged ports and this, you know, hundreds of miles that they have to punch through to get there. They get there, those ships departed Nome for their return journey on January 21st, and they are still not through the ice yet. They are about, I believe as of Thursday, they were about 230 miles south of Nome and still had quite a ways to go before they reached the water's edge.
So this is a very expensive undertaking, whatever else it is.
It sounds like an expensive undertaking. Like, I would imagine it would be. The Coast Guard has said that they're not going to release firm numbers on what this specific escort cost. What it means for the future of shipping in the Arctic, I don't know that we can really say. I think there are lots of projections and there are lots of policy hopes. We know that the Native Corporation, which is the fuel buyer, which ordered this particular load with a tanker from the Russian Far East because there wasn't one any closer that could do the job, Arctic class fuel tanker, has said they hope they never have to ship this way again. You know, they got themselves into a little bit of a bind when a former supplier failed to come through, and they had this horrible November storm, which delayed the already delayed, fuel load that would have been on its way. But we have people who are saying, look, this is the U.S. Coast Guard. It opens up navigable waterways on the East Coast and in other areas where we see ice year-round. There's no reason they shouldn't be able to do it here. We're just taking advantage of what's already in place for the American public. I don't know that that's entirely true. I mean, on one level, that's true. But certainly, Alaska doesn't have the infrastructure to do that routinely. But I think that's the argument from the government leaders and policymakers, is projecting that we will have more Arctic shipping, that we do need to have a Coast Guard presence, that we do need to be defensive.
We're running short of time, so I need to move on to Kyle. Excuse me. Kyle, quickly, who is Patrick V. Davids and what happened to him?
Patrick V. Davids is a financial advisor who lives in Anchorage and has for a few years. And he was, there was a story, I forget what day, maybe Sunday, he was hit by a share ride van. Those commuter vans that go from the Matsu to Anchorage and back, there's also one or more that go to Girdwood. You know, people work at the hotel, they got to get back and forth. It hit this man. He was on the roadway, according to the troopers. It hit him, drug him 400 feet. He suffered life-threatening injuries. The next day, court paperwork was filed or kind of appeared, became public, showing that he, at the time that he was hit and injured while walking across the Seward Highway, was facing very, very serious child sex abuse charges. There was a warrant out for arrest. He was wanted by police, for child molestation. And so that kind of certainly added context to questions about and just raised more questions about what was he doing on the road.
Yeah, there's a story within the story. We're going to run out of time here. So finally, for the last couple of minutes, Len Anderson, this is your last show. And this is a loss to the community and a loss to me personally because of how much I've enjoyed working with you. Now you're retiring. How long have you been here at KSK?
8.5 years. It's and the how longer, did, longest how, I've how ever did, stayed at one place.
How did you get into broadcasting?
My father was a broadcaster, and he wanted me to do something else, so I was teaching college. My first broadcast.
Something else was you were going to be a scholar of Norse, weren't you? Didn't you get an advanced degree in Norse languages?
Master's in English and minor in American history studies, and then went into Scandinavian studies with strengthened Viking literature.
Is this too much of a cliche to note that it was at the University of Minnesota?
No. No. University of Wisconsin, yes, but not Minnesota.
Some of your favorite moments from a long career here in Alaska, one or two?
Oh, a lot of people I've met. Going to the villages like Shugnak and broadcasting live for an entire day in 15-minute segments, lying on the floor because the little kids were a little concerned about a big white guy with a microphone so I could talk to the kindergartners.
And this would have been broadcast in Shugnak.
Oh yeah, which was kind of a problem because they had trouble hearing the actual origin point Kotzebue. So that was it. A lot of people I've met, polar bear hunters, just all sorts of wonderful Alaskans.
And then you finally got to come to Anchorage and meet some bureaucrats.
Oh, they haunt the bush as well.
Thank you very much for joining us. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.